Welcome to Intuitive Transformations with your host, Sylvia Henderson, and discover tools, wisdom, and inspiration that will empower you to transform your life. Sylvia is an intuitive life coach and energy healer with a growing practice that is focused on empowering others to be more of who they want to be. For the next hour, join Sylvia and explore and unravel anything in the way of you creating the life that you would love to live on the Om Times Radio Network.
Well, hello and welcome to the Intuitive Transformations radio show, where you will find tools that you can use to change and transform your life every Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Om Times Radio Network, the voice of consciousness at omtimes.com. This is Sylvia Henderson, your host, and if you'd like to learn more about me and the work that I do, then please visit my website at intuitivetransformations.net. And also from my website, you can sign up to be added to my email group and download a free 20-minute healing audio called Healing Fear During Uncertain Times, which will support you in releasing fear, worry, and anxiety, especially during times of change and uncertainty. Well, today I have an extremely special guest joining me on the show whose name you most likely will easily recognize. His name is Dr. Amit Goswami, and he is an award-winning quantum activist and a theoretical quantum physicist who is here today to share his insights on the foundation of life and how consciousness provides the answers for everything. Dr. Amit Goswami became internationally recognized when he appeared in the film What the Bleep Do We Know, and later appeared in its sequel Down the Rabbit Hole, as well as the documentary Dalai Lama Renaissance and the award-winning documentary The Quantum Activist. He is currently a pioneer of the new paradigm of science called Science Within Consciousness, an idea he applicates in his seminal book, The Self-Aware Universe, where he also solves the quantum measurement problem elucidating the famous observer effect. Since then, he has written many other popular books based on his research on quantum physics and consciousness, which include The Visionary Window, Physics of the Soul, The Quantum Doctor, Creative Evolution, God is Not Dead, How Quantum Activism Can Save Civilization, Quantum Creativity, Think Quantum, Be Creative, Quantum Economics, Unlocking the Power of an Economics of Consciousness, and his soon-to-be-released book, The Everything Answer Book, How Quantum Science Explains Love, Death, and the Meaning of Life, which will be available April 1st, 2017. And it is both my honor and pleasure to have Dr. Goswami join us here today to discuss and share some of his brilliant insights from this soon-to-be-released book, The Everything Answer Book. Dr. Amit Goswami, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sylvia. Good to be here.
Well, I am absolutely delighted to have you here, and I'm so excited to have this conversation because I've always been fascinated with quantum theory and quantum physics. Dr. Goswami, there are so many profound insights that you can share, that you have shared within the pages of your soon-to-be-released book, The Everything Answer Book, and you've provided such a brilliantly layered pathway for the reader to follow while you explain everything through the reality of consciousness. So to begin, why is it important for us to view ourselves, our world, our experiences, and all of existence really from consciousness-based science versus Newtonian matter-based science?
Yes. This is the most important question to start with. Newtonian matter-based science can describe us only to the extent that we are machines. And admittedly, we do have some conditioning in our existence and behavior. We do have a genetic dispositions, and that conditions us to some extent. And then we have conditioning that we grow up with, nurture, that part also contributes. And then even quantum physics admits that we do have reincarnation, so past life conditioning too contributes to our conditioned existence. But beyond that, we have creativity. Beyond that, we have the new, we have feelings, we have intuition. These experiences are beyond what a machine can experience. In truth, machine cannot even fully process the mind, because machine can only process the computable part of the mind, content of thought, but not the meaning of thought. So in that way, the machine description really falls short of the human condition. And recognizing that, we have to reformulate science anyway, or if we couldn't, then that would be a failure of science itself. Fortunately, we don't have to go as far as to declare science as a failed enterprise for describing the human being. Quantum physics has come along, and it has given us a new basis to look at things, and that is the basis we are talking about today. Consciousness is the ground of everything. If consciousness is the ground of everything, then mind and matter both can be included in consciousness. And when we do that, we can fully describe the human being, including both conditioning and creativity.
I see. And so when you say consciousness, what, you know, I know that's a big topic to try to distill and define briefly, but what is consciousness? Because you talk about local consciousness and then also non-local consciousness. What do you mean by that?
Yes, very important. So this is what quantum physics tells us, very unequivocally. Quantum physics says that there are two domains of reality. One domain is where we have actuality, as we experience, you know, sensing, thinking, feeling, intuition. All these things comes with objects of experience, and we as the subject of experience experience this object. So that is the consciousness that is explicit, that is manifest. Then quantum physics also says that there is a domain of potentiality in which all objects of experience become potentiality, possibility waves. And this is what consciousness is. Consciousness is that domain of potentiality. It consists of both the potentiality of subject and the potentiality of object. And when we choose from this potentiality of object, then we get the manifestation, conversion of potentiality into actuality that gives us the experience. So in the domain of potentiality, consciousness is unconscious enough. This is what Freud discovered as unconscious. We have no awareness. The subject-object awareness is missing. But in the domain of potentiality, when domain of potentiality becomes domain of actuality, giving us an actual experience, we are split as subject as opposed to object. And that's the awareness that we experience.
I see. So in our local consciousness, the subject of experience, we live in a 3D reality that's influenced heavily by the concept of duality, or rather separation, such as good versus evil, right versus wrong, left versus right. From a quantum physics perspective, is duality a reality within this non-local consciousness of potentiality?
Yes, I should have mentioned that what I'm calling domain of potentiality is also a domain of oneness. There is no distinction between consciousness and its possibilities. And this domain of oneness is also visualized as a domain in which communication is instantaneous without signals. This is why we call it non-local, signal-less communication. Whereas in the space-time domain of reality, we call it local because communication requires signals, which always take a finite amount of time going through space. a signal going through space taking a finite amount of time is always involved in communication in space and time. This is why we call it local consciousness. So in that way. Now, of course, this idea has become most important when we recognize that both domains are important for our functioning. It's not one versus the other. The unconscious contributes to what we experience in the conscious.
I see. So the non-local consciousness, could this be also defined as God or the Tao or the universe? Or from a spiritual point of view, how would one look at non-local consciousness as a defined concept?
Very good point. Indeed, spiritual traditions call it God, but you have to be a little bit careful. This nomenclature, although if you read the New Testament, Jesus' statements, then you find plenty of statements like that which suggest non-locality. For example, in Luke, he tells his disciples that if you are looking for God in the sky, then of course birds would have found it long time ago. If you are looking for God in water, then fish would have discovered it. And then he says it's neither here nor there, makes it very clear that it's nowhere to be found in space and time. You have to look at it outside of space and time, which suggests something like oneness. But in the traditional popular description of Christianity, mind you, this God became converted into some sort of a majestic, super-duper individual God, a white male, precisely. And this, of course, has produced a kind of a distorted picture of reality in the Western mind ever since. This was done sort of 400 years ago. And this almighty God has given the idea of almighty dominator, king, who is a representation of God, and has caused havoc in the whole world. As you know, the world becomes divided into dominator-dominated dynamics. But all that is now past, although some remnants of it still hangs on, so you cannot completely ignore it either. So is God non-local consciousness? Yes, provided we recognize the God of the mystery, like Jesus.
Yeah.
But if we recognize the God of the priests today, then of course they will say, oh no, God is a guy who is sitting in a throne in the heavens and doling out punishments and rewards for us when we die and all that stuff.
It really does depend on our definition of God then, doesn't it? So I know we're going to be going into a break. So when we return, there will be more of Dr. Amit Goswami on the Intuitive Transformations radio show. So please stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment.
The future of internet radio is here. Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
Hello, I'm Miriam Knight of New Consciousness Review, inviting you to my new show where I interview the rising stars of the conscious awakening. We'll explore the many faces of consciousness in action and intriguing perspectives on life, the universe, and everything in between. Join us each Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern on the Rising Stars Show.
When I was little, I didn't talk for a long time. I was sensitive to lights and sounds, so I built secret hiding places where they couldn't get in. Sometimes I did the same things over and over until one day I found out I had autism. My family got me help. Slowly, I learned how to live with it better.
Early intervention can make a lifetime of difference. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. You're listening to Sylvia Henderson on Intuitive Transformations radio show at ohmtimes.com. And I have with me today my guest, Dr. Amit Goswami, quantum physicist. And before we went to the break, Dr. Goswami was just sharing about what non-local consciousness is and that how some can define that as God, but really that depends on what your definition of God is. And if you can define God, I believe, as something that is neutral, then that probably more closely mirrors what non-local consciousness is. Is that correct, Dr. Goswami?
Yes, neutral, and if you recognize God as a oneness experience. These experiences are not very uncommon. You know, when we walk in the forest, when we look at the vast ocean, or even the beauty of a sunset, sometimes we fall into this oneness of consciousness where it feels like we are one with everything. Many people, including the discoverer of quantum physics, co-discoverer Arun Schrodinger, he had this oneness experience. I am this whole world. I have experienced this, and many people have reported experiencing this. So that's the kind of oneness that quantum physics posits, that reality at the level of potentiality is about.
Beautiful, beautiful. So when we think about who we are then, that does invite us to explore who is even thinking that thought. And who is observing the one that is thinking the thoughts? Can you talk a little bit about the observer of our thoughts and our experiences?
Yes, this is the important part of the quantum physics, how it gave us the consciousness, one consciousness as the reality of potentiality. So it started with the idea that quantum objects are both waves and particles. And then the question arose, where do the waves reside? And the answer came that the waves reside in the domain of potentiality outside of space and time, where non-locality reigns, signalless communication. So that means everything is one. This is now experimental data. This cannot be debated. Beneath the separateness that we experience, there is a oneness. No debate about this. This is experimental data. And then comes the question of, all right, so what do we call it? What do we call this oneness? That's where the observer effect comes in. We notice that when we measure, I said before that measurement or observation changes the potentiality into actuality of our experience. An observer is essential for that. So what is the observer doing? If you look at it, then it's something a little paradoxical, because before the conversion of potentiality into actuality, observer himself or herself, the brain, is a potentiality. It's just a wave of possibility. It's not an actual brain. So we have a peculiar situation where the presence of the observer brain is needed to produce the conversion of possibility into actuality. And yet, if the possibility is not converted into actuality, then where is the brain? There is no manifest brain. So this paradox can be solved only by assuming that in the process of conversion of potentiality into actuality, not only is the object created, but also the observer created. The brain itself is manifested too, in that same process, circular process, but in the process, consciousness identifies with the brain. There is something very special in the brain that captures consciousness, that special thing we call a tangled hierarchy, a hierarchy from which one cannot escape. So that's how the observer effect allows us to identify that the domain of potentiality must be consciousness itself, and it's our consciousness. We are not separate from it. Our consciousness is coming from a oneness which identifies with our brain, and in that process becomes individualized. And eventually we see ourselves separate from the object of experience.
Wow. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. That gives us a lot to really chew upon, because it is it does take quantum physics to really be able to allow us to understand that conceptually through our brains. So from the awareness of potentiality and multiple possibilities, you also talk about the importance of creativity, that it's very vital. And in doing so, you also talk about suffering being a catalyst, or the catalyst behind creativity. And as you know, humanity wishes not to suffer. But is suffering actually purposeful in order for humanity to expand and grow creatively?
Well, the role of suffering is certainly an important one, and we have to consider it because some people, including myself, are not attracted towards getting beyond our machine existence unless we are pushed badly by suffering, unless, you know, so to speak, mystical language now, God hits us with a 2x4, that kind of thing. But, you know, there is a better way, of course. And I did require suffering initially, but now, you know, my curiosity is aroused, and I don't need to suffer anymore in order to investigate reality in the reality of oneness and all these nice things, values, love, beauty, justice, truth, which also is part of that same exploration. I don't need suffering anymore. My curiosity propels me all over the world, looking for all these things and changing myself into a transformed person. So I hope that the listeners are encouraged by this. Yes, initially suffering is very good, but you don't really have to stay in that suffering dynamic for very long. Once you get the taste of what this domain of potentiality holds for you, all the wonderful possibilities that are open to us, only subject to our exploration, creative exploration, once you wake up to that, there's no stopping you. You will be curious, and curiosity alone will propel you, will motivate you.
Well, I most definitely prefer the curiosity roadmap versus the suffering myself as well. So how does one begin to get a taste of that oneness? How does one begin to choose curiosity over suffering? Does meditation aid in that process?
Yes, if we are able to listen to these sagely advices that are given to us from age-old spiritual traditions, if we could listen to that, yeah. I mean, I was told in my very childhood, because I grew up in a kind of spiritual society, but life circumstances took me in a different direction. I could not stay with that kind of advice. I tried meditating early teenagehood and so forth, but never really got the hang of it. And so, you know, for me, suffering was essential. But if we can, this is my favorite dream, if we can build a society with the new quantum knowledge where we teach meditation, we teach yoga, stuff like that, Tai Chi. Now, there are many, many mind slowing down exercises which would arouse our creative motivations just out of curiosity. And we will not be so careless about suffering being so important to us at a later stage of our life. You know, I could have begun my journey of transformation much earlier, but I have to wait till my midlife in order to get suffering piled up so that I had to do something about it.
You know, you touched on something that I think is really important for people to hear, and that is mind slowing down exercises, that actually opens the door and allows us to move beyond our suffering, whether it is meditation or Tai Chi or yoga. So why is that? What is it about slowing down our thoughts, our mind, that allows us to
When we progress? Slow down, our unconscious takes over. This is the thing, Sylvia. This is the crucial thing. Creativity consists of both doing and being. If we are into doing, we are constantly thinking. All doing comes with thinking. And so mind is just constantly occupied. There is no scope for the unconscious, for this oneness to come into play. Unconscious is where the oneness is. So if you want the oneness to play a role and the values that govern oneness to come to our life, then we got to give the unconscious a chance. Of course, every night we sleep, that is true, and that is unconscious. But the problem is that if we don't prepare enough, then sleep doesn't come to our aid very much. So much more help is unconscious episodes during our waking hours. And we gain that if we slow down our thoughts, if we slow down our feelings, then in between thoughts, in between feelings, where are we? It turns out we are in the unconscious. And that unconscious, what happens is that the objects of waves of potentiality, they grow. If you throw a pebble in a pond, you will see that the water waves are growing. So similarly, objects are waves of possibility. So these waves grow in possibility in the unconscious and become bigger and bigger pools of potentiality to choose from. And of course, given the choice, what would you choose from? A bigger pool of potentiality or a small pool of possibility? Obviously, you choose a bigger pool of potentiality. When you recognize it, then obviously anybody can see the virtue of slowing down.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I've had that experience, and once you taste of it, you want more, and you want more, and you want more. So I know we're going to head into another break, and when we return, there will be more of Dr. Amit Goswami on the Intuitive Transformations Radio Show on OhmTimes.com. Please stay tuned. We'll be back right after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM. As difficult as it is to believe, there are places in Africa where human traffickers sell albino children and their body parts for use in magic rituals. Humanity Healing International is actively working in Uganda to change this paradigm. The Albino Rescue Project finds albino children who are at risk and places them in safe schools and environments where they can learn and grow free from fear. To learn more or to sponsor a child, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
Hey, let me ask you something. Would you seat your 3-year-old child on a windowsill? Would you seat them beside a lit fireplace or by the deep end of a pool? One last question. Would you seat your child in a car seat that's not correct for them? Car crashes are a leading killer of children ages 1 to 13. Secure their future. Seat them in the correct car seat. For more information, visit safercar.gov/the right seat. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is Sylvia Henderson with Dr. Amit Goswami, and we are actually discussing his soon-to-be-released book, The Everything Answer Book, How Quantum Science Explains Love, Death, and the Meaning of Life. And this book will be available April 1st, 2017, and I'm sure you can get it on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, and all of the local bookstores will be carrying this as well. And Dr. Goswami, one of the things that you talk about in that book is something Newtonian science touches upon, which is the conditioned mind. But what quantum physics explains so well is the concept of karma and dharma and even reincarnation and how they interrelate and how for some on the planet, suffering seems to be an endless journey. And how does karma, dharma, and reincarnation have an impact on someone in that particular situation?
This is such an important question, especially in the culture that we live in today, because, you know, after the 5th century AD, because of political reason, Christianity shied away from the concept of reincarnation. And this has caused a lot of cognitive dissonance in the among the psychologists of how to get a good hold on what the problems are with human development. The problems are precisely that our incarnational karma, as you put it, influences us greatly, and karma is nothing but propensities or habit patterns that we bring from our past life. Now, some of these habit patterns are good. For example, learning to learn, that's a very good habit. Learning to process meaning, that's a very good habit. Or being purposeful, very good habit. Learning to love, very good habit. But there are also likewise very bad habits, procrastination, lack of forgiveness, lack of acceptance. These are very bad habits that we also grow. And if we have only bad habits, then these bad habits will prevent us from creative exploration. So that's the problem with karma. So when it's a bad karma, we don't mean that we done some wrong to somebody and that somebody is going to get us. No, it's nature which is going to get us. That karma means that we have developed some bad habits, and those bad habits are going to keep us away from investigating the new, investigating what makes us happy, like love, beauty, and abundance. These things make us happy. This is the problem of karma. Dharma, that's another very beautiful concept. It turns out that before we come into this life, we actually choose the kind of archetype, these intuitive objects that we wonder about, that everybody wants to explore, like love, beauty, justice, truth, wholeness. I have already mentioned them several times. You know, who doesn't want to explore love? Who doesn't want to explore beauty? Who doesn't want abundance in his or her life? So these are the things we want. But the question is, you know, we never find them. Some of us are forever dissatisfied because we never found what kind of archetype will give us the happiness that we seek, the satisfaction that we seek. And the answer is that, well, it comes from the incarnation. You chose it before you died the last time. And you have to remember it. Of course, we also choose a birth which is supposed to be helpful to remind us. For example, if you want to explore music, it's the archetype of beauty, then you would choose a musical family to be born so that the remembrance comes easily. But you know, it may so happen that you were born in a musical family, but then your parents divorced and you moved away from the musical family. One of your parents was not a musician, and that's the one that you chose to stay with. And then your propensities coming with that particular exploration would never be triggered. And that is the problem. So it is very important for everybody to make a concerted effort. If you are not satisfied with your life, that's a sure sign that you have not found your dharma, the archetype that you chose for yourself to explore in this life. Now, of course, finally, the question is, how do we know that reincarnation happens? Well, first of all, there is very, very beautiful data, and coming from many directions. Just look at children, how quickly they learn. That itself shows that they are not born as tabula rasa, as you know, empty slate, as materialists assume. They are born with a lot of propensities that are ready to be triggered. So as soon as you put suitable stimuli, immediately they will trigger their potentiality that they already had in the past life, and that's why some children grow up to suffer knowledgeable people so fast. You know, I myself was one of the a little bit of a child prodigy. You know, I could recite poems and entire stories at the age of 4. My parents got a lot of mileage out of it because, you know, I remember being exhibited. Amit, come and recite that story. And I do it, of course, with a great amount of joy. But where did that come from? It came from, obviously, past life, because not many children have that kind of capacity. So in that way, we have a theory now based on quantum physics. This concept of non-locality helps us to understand memory can be local in the brain. That is what most memories are like. But memories of learning, what we learn, this capacity to learn or learning to learn, these capacities are not stored in the brain. They are stored in outside space and time altogether. In the ancient literature, they are called akashic memory. This is very interesting. The word akasha in Sanskrit means outside of space. So, you know, I always marvel, how could those people, without the concept of quantum physics and non-locality, even intuited this kind of thing, that there would be two kinds of memory. One kind would be outside of space and time, and the other kind will perish with the brain. And that's a good thing, too, because otherwise you'd be so burdened with all these local memories that we want to get rid of. We want to start with a new slate, and we do. But the propensities are important. If we had to start with new propensities every time, that would just take too much time away. So it's a good thing that we bring propensities from past life.
You know, one of the other things you talk about, which I found really interesting, was poker karma. And for me, when I read that, well, that explains why we're not exact duplicates of our previous lives. Would you mind talking a little bit about that?
Say it again, the karma?
The poker karma. It's that you get, you were talking about how you were dealt, like, you could be dealt 5 cards of information from your past life, but then the rest of it is kind of randomized.
Yes. Very, very, very important. Very important piece of information, Sylvia. I'm glad you raised that issue. So what happened? Let me tell you about this data that was collected by a past life regression therapist in Ohio. He, named David Klein, he had many, many people that he regressed to past lives and kept a regular journal of all these people's data. And he found that many of his clients were talking about lifetimes, consecutive lifetimes. And he started comparing the propensities that karma brought in each of these lifetimes. And he found that the propensities they bring are not accumulative. You don't bring all of the propensities that you gathered in your immediate past life. So why do you bring only a portion of it? This is the question that arises. In fact, you know, clients call this poker karma. It's like you don't play all 52 cards in poker. You play with only 5 or 7 cards. So the analogy is obviously clear that you bring only a small number of propensities out of your whole bunch of accumulated propensities. And why is that? That is because you want to use those propensities for a specific archetype to explore. For example, in my own life, I know that I came to explore the archetype of wholeness, and that requires propensities that I have. And, you know, it is similarly important for people to recognize what kind of propensities you had as a child, and then try to activate them, try to use them, and that will bring up the concept of Dharma in your life. You will find the archetype which is particularly suited for exploration of, you know, with those propensities are particularly suited for the archetypal soul. This is why you brought those particular propensities. I myself got a little lost because there are many life circumstances which did not allow me to stay within the life that I started. So indeed, I was not following the archetype of wholeness for bulk of my life until I was 37. And then I had this experience where I was basically told that, well, look, why are you living this way? And I knew that I had to change my life. And in course of that, I recognized that, I have to integrate my life and livelihood and all these concepts came back to me.
So one of the other things that you touch upon in your book is about unprocessed emotions and how they can affect us, especially physically.
Yeah.
Why is it so important that we process our emotions? And I'm a big proponent of that because that's the work that I help people with. But from a quantum physics point of view, why is that so important?
Yes, I mean, this emotion, question of emotion is a very important one because, you know, we are born with this negative emotional brain circuit, which, of course, plays havoc with us. You know, those emotions that everybody recognizes, anger, lust, competitiveness, jealousy, envy, all those things. They create so much problems for us, but they are built into us. So we cannot do very much about them except to realize that it is in our power to make positive emotions as well. We don't have them in the brain as we are born, but we can make them. We can build them in our brain by creative explorations of the archetypes. For example, if we explore the archetype of love, not only the thought of feeling.
Well, we're going to go into a break, Dr. Goswami. I'm so sorry, but can you just hold that thought until after we return and we'll continue the conversation on unprocessed emotions then. We will be right back in just a few moments. Please stay tuned.
Bringing a more conscious lifestyle to your world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Host your show on IOM FM, the radio network of Om Times Media, one of the more recognized brand names in the conscious community, and is backed by the extensive marketing reach of Om Times. Hosting a show on IOM FM immediately connects you with our extensive, dedicated community.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and the text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
We are back, and Dr. Goswami, before the music came in for the break, you were just talking about how we can create positive emotions to replace those other emotions of anger and jealousy and hatred and judgment, negative judgments.
Yes.
And so, yes, please continue.
So, as I was saying, we cannot get rid of the negative emotional brain circuit, but we can balance them with positive emotional brain circuit. So, you know, suppose I start to explore the archetype of love, which is not difficult because this is one of the archetypes actually which is built into us. We don't have to really get initiated by making any big fanfare of exploration. It's built into us in the sense that we have an immune system in our body in the form of one part of it is called thymus gland. It is in the region of the heart. And the job of the thymus gland is to distinguish between me and not me. Now, when a stimulus comes to us, like, you know, you are going on the street and the person of the opposite sex comes at you, and you look at him, you look at her, and you find, oh, I am having these enormous feelings in my heart chakra. Familiar? Yes. We call it heart throb or tingles in the heart or heartwarming. What does it signify? Usually, if the ages are appropriate, it will signify romantic love. It's built into it. Why? Because the immune system is now getting a rest. The distinction of me and not me is suspended. This is why the lovers will say, you are mine. And both of them will say, you are mine. So you have recognized the other as part of you. There is no longer any separation between the two of you. That is what we call romantic love. So this is built into us. Romantic love, unfortunately, does not last. But it can start as a doorway to the exploration of the archetype of love. So it is so wonderful to do that. And many people in my acquaintance have done some of the explorations, and they have a loving relationship. You know, people live long time, 15, 20, 30 years in a committed relationship that requires the awakening of love. So if you do that, you would have a love cycle in your brain. So what happens then? People have studied this now quite a bit. What happens is that you still have head circuit too, but when the head circuits come along and get activated, you don't feel bad for very long. An ordinary person who has not worked on love, does not have a positive emotional brain circuit, could stay in hate lifelong. We know that. People stay enemies for lifelong. But people who have a love circuit in their brain don't stay in hate for more than a few minutes. Even a few seconds, they already are over it, and they're immediately feeling love again in their heart. I have seen this change in myself. You know, I explored the archetype of love quite thoroughly and found that it is quite possible to love your enemy. I mean, Jesus says that in the Bible when you first encounter it. You know, my thinking like you was, okay, maybe Jesus was a little bit, you know, off his regular self that day, but not true. Jesus was telling the absolute truth. It is possible to love your enemy, and it's a surprise. You build that circuit in your head, and you will find that you have the capacity of loving your enemy. You cannot, in fact, hate for very long. As I said, 2-3 seconds, maybe 2-3 minutes at the most. After that, the hate will be gone. It will give way to this love that you feel.
And that alone will help you step out of suffering for sure. I can't believe we're almost at the end of the show. This has gone so very, very quickly. Real quick before we continue, I do want to remind everyone that Dr. Amit Goswami's brand new book is coming out on April 1st. It's the Everything Answer Book, How Quantum Science Explains Love, Death, and the Meaning of Life. And if you would like to know more about Dr. Amit Goswami, you can go to his website at amitgoswami.org. And Amit is A-M-I-T. Goswami is G-O-S-W-A-M-I. And that's amitgoswami.org. And so, Dr. Goswami, one last thing I do want to ask you about as we're moving to the end of the show is that I know that in December of last year, you received an invitation to meet with John of God for healing. And now for those who are listening that don't know, who may not know who John of God is, he's an extraordinary healer in Brazil who works with healing entities and with different levels of consciousness. And Dr. Goswami, would you mind sharing what you experienced from your encounter with John of God from a quantum physics perspective?
Well, I don't know if the encounter was long enough to give a solid assessment of John of God. All I can tell you is that I was there for 2 whole days, and I really did feel that I was having a wonderful experience, a kind of a healing experience. And of course, it just so happened that John of God gave me one demonstration Usually, his work is no longer involves actual surgery. They call it psychic surgery, what they do. They do no physical touching or anything. People just sit there and meditate, and things happen in their psyche, mostly unbeknownst to them. But they feel good. But for maybe just for my benefit, when I was with him, close to him, he called me in front. He was at the same time performing an actual physical operation on a woman. And he actually cut her stomach and blood came out, and he put a suture on it. And all this was done with skills that he's not supposed to have. He's an ordinary man. But when he channels, he gets this extra skill, and it requires propensities that really is beyond his psychophysiological capacity. So that's something that people have researched, and this is why I myself have done some research on it. And this is what makes us think that channeling is really real. So this I can vouch. And the other thing I can vouch for is that I myself felt very good while in that place. I mean, it really felt like an ashram. And the meditative state that I was in, especially in one session, was really quite wonderful. It just felt that oneness that I was talking about before. You know, that place is famous for these loving entities, they call them. These loving entities give you love. And that's what produces the healing, basically. And, you know, I have a theory about that. Quantum physics enables us to make a theory about that. Love, as I said earlier, is necessary for the immune system to get some love. It's as necessary as every night we need sleep to give the neocortex a rest. Similarly, immune system is the second most important system in our body that also needs rest. When you are not having love, when you are not having love in your life, you are depriving the immune system from its deserved rest. And that puts your body's organs into dysfunction. And this eventually can produce serious disease like cancer. In fact, somebody did a study, bereaved women have higher instances of breast cancer. And this can be explained easily by assuming that, yes, bereaved women indeed deprive themselves of love because they feel that without their men, they cannot love again. Or society compels them not to love for a period of time. No, don't exclude love from your life because you were really depriving your immune system from healthy functioning.
And when you say love, you're speaking of unconditional love, love without condition.
Yes, I am speaking of unconditional love, but even conditional love is better than no love.
I agree. I totally agree with you. That is absolutely correct. All love is good. Well, yeah. I know we only have a few more moments, a few more minutes actually before the conclusion of the show. And we have covered so much, but I know that we have also just barely scratched the surface of what you provide in your book. Even when you were speaking about this collective feeling that everyone has at the John of God Casa, I was thinking of the morphogenetic field that Rupert Sheldrake talks about quite a bit and has brought to light in existence, that collective consciousness that we all really share, which is also part of the all, the oneness as well. So do you believe that with the global changes, not just climate, but just all the changes we're witnessing now around the world, knowing that suffering can be a catalyst for change, that this might be the catalyst that will allow us on a mass consciousness level to shed our myopic, materialistic worldview and begin to live in a quantum world after all?
Bless you. That is a wonderful thought, and I completely agree with you. I think in my own life, there's plenty of proof of that, and I've studied life of creative people over and over again, so many of them. And all of that bears out the fact that we need crisis to move, most of us, and same thing for society. We have a crisis at our hands, political crisis in this country, economic crisis in other countries, leadership crisis in other countries, and of course, terrorism for many countries. So these things in crisis proportions are really waking up a lot of people in a lot of countries. Some of the movements have temporarily failed, like Arab Spring or the Wall Street Initiative that happened here in America. But they are just a beginning. Those movements eventually will produce fruit and will have big changes, big awakening in terms of the worldview itself. You know, instead of the current polarization between religion and science, we have an integration of spirituality and science under the aegis of the quantum physics and what quantum physics can teach us. This is what I'm looking forward to, and I hope you are too, because there is no sense in being pessimistic. It's just a waste of time.
I agree. I am hoping for that as well, Dr. Goswami. And yes, you're right. There's no sense in being pessimistic about any of this. We must remain positive, and we must believe that all of this is for our highest and best good. Dr. Goswami, thank you so much for being on the show. It has been amazing and a moment I will always remember. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And please know I'll be back again next week. Until then, know that you are loved greatly, thoroughly, and entirely. Take care and have a wonderful week. Goodbye for now.